Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and today again I'm live. If you were listening last week, you know that we played a series of recorded programs. I was teaching for Youth with a Mission all week in Hawaii, and the time zone difference rendered it impossible for me to do the show live, although I have the capability usually of doing the show remotely from other places than home. I was unable to do it because I was teaching all morning, and the time that we are on the air pretty much overlapped the time I was teaching, which is why I couldn't do it, and we had to play recorded programs. But as usual, we are live again today, and so you can call if you have any questions from the Bible or about Christianity, anything related to that, or if you have any difference of opinion with the host you'd like to talk about, an alternate viewpoint that you hold and would like to defend, feel free to call me. I'm on for about an hour from 2 to 3 in the afternoon, Pacific Standard Time. You can call any time now. We have some lines still open, and the number is 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. Our first caller today is Bob calling from Bend, Oregon. Bob, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hey, welcome back, Steve. Hope you had fun out in Hawaii.
Well, I taught 3 hours every morning and 3 hours every night.
There you go. That sounds
so I was working a six-hour day there.
Well, while you're in 80-degree temperatures, we had about minus 15 degrees out here.
Is that right? Well, it got pretty cold in California while I was gone, too.
And we have this cold spell, and lo and behold, I had some Jehovah Witnesses knock on my door.
Dedicated, aren't they?
You know, I've never even had anybody at my house. It's so remote.
Oh, is that right? And here at 15 below, there's no, they didn't come when it was 15 below, I don't suppose.
No, they came when it was about 20 degrees.
That's still pretty cold.
Yeah. Anyways, you know, the first thing that popped in my mind, and I've got four study Bibles, and they all kind of seem to have a little different opinion on it, but 2 John 1:10.
Uh-huh.
Should I or should I not let them in the house?
Well, when John says if someone brings some other gospel, don't receive them into your house, what he's talking about there is, and if you compare this with 3 John also, these two epistles talk about showing hospitality to traveling teachers. In 3 John, Gaius was the recipient of the epistle, and John told him that it was good that he received the messengers from Christ, and he kept them in his home, and he showed hospitality to them. And to the elect lady in 2 John, he says if people bring a different gospel, don't accept them into your house. Now, receiving them into your house, as I understand it, means allowing them to come and stay under your hospitality so that you're, in a sense, supporting them with your, you're giving them lodging and food, and this is something they need in order to conduct their business. If they are true messengers of God, as John tells Gaius in 3 John, this is a worthy thing to do, to show this kind of hospitality. But if they are false teachers, as he tells the elect lady in 2 John, you shouldn't show them that kind of support and that kind of hospitality. Now, when he says don't receive them into your house, I think that's the context. I think it's don't let them stay with you at your expense, because then you are a participant in their evil deeds. You're basically a partner with them. As he also says to the elect lady, you know, if you say Godspeed or give them some kind of encouragement in what they're doing, if they're false teachers, you're kind of linking yourself to them. You're invoking blessing upon their work, and you become a participant in some measure in the damage that they do. And so he says not to do that. Now, when it comes to inviting a Jehovah's Witness in out of the 20-degree cold into your living room to talk about the things of God, because you want to evangelize them, that's a different thing entirely. And I would be all for inviting them in, giving them something to drink, showing the general kindness that you would show to any stranger as a Christian. But that's because you're there to evangelize them. That's a very different thing than if you're just playing the host to a visiting false teacher who's going to be doing some kind of campaigning for their false doctrine in your town, and you're providing a lodging for them. So you're not really, when you invite the Jehovah's Witness into your home to visit with them for a few hours, that's not really the same thing, I don't think, that John's talking about in 2 John.
Okay. I kind of leaned that way, but I opted not to. I ended up staying on the, you know, the porch for about a half hour with them.
That's fine, too. That's fine, too. I mean, if you're willing to go out in the cold with them, that's just as generous as having them come in out of the cold.
Well, yeah. I mean, I would rather, you know, have them sat down at the table and, you know, just kick back and go through some scriptures. But
I've had them in my home many times, and I'm always glad when they come by. They don't actually come by very often anymore.
I had her interested enough to where she came by a second time. And this is a gal that was in the... has been a Jehovah's Witness for 38 years.
Mm.
So, you know, I've got a book here, Reasoning from Scriptures with Jehovah's Witnesses by Ron Rabbit.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And I've got to tell you, their answers are verbatim. It was like I was talking to the book.
Well, yeah, anyone who's talked to Jehovah's Witnesses very much knows that they have pat answers. And that's because when they go to their Kingdom Hall, they teach them what it is that we're likely to say, then what it is that they're supposed to say in return.
Yeah, they have a book called Reasoning from Scriptures also.
Yeah, they basically have verbatim answers that they're expected to memorize and give, and that's why you'll hear the same. That's why Ron Rhodes could predict to you what they're going to say.
Yeah, he was,
because they always say it.
But I did catch him on one thing. You know, I was researching the internet also, and I was going through this one page, and this lady said, "This is what brought me out." And it was in Revelation 1:8 where it says, "I am the Alpha and Omega," says
yeah.
That one. And I contrasted that going back to Revelation, 22, where Jesus Christ says he's the Alpha and Omega, the first and the last, beginning and the end.
Yeah.
And they didn't have an answer for that.
No, they can't answer that. That is truly an unanswerable argument. Because in Revelation 1:8, when they have it Jehovah speaking. You know, they say it's not Jesus speaking. They say it's Jehovah saying, "I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end," says Jehovah, who was and who is and is to come, the Almighty. Now they say, well, only Jehovah is the Almighty.
Yeah.
Jesus is not the Almighty, they say. Jesus is a mighty God, as they understand, you know, Isaiah 9:6 to be saying.
Yeah.
Right. But they say he's mighty, but he's not almighty. And obviously the speaker in Revelation 1:8 says, "I am the Almighty," which would mean, of course, I'm Jehovah.
Yeah.
But the same speaker is speaking later on, and it says in verse 18, well, you got to read the verse 17.
I know it like the back of my hand right
now. Yeah. verse 17 says, "I am the first and the last. I am he who lives and was dead, and behold, I'm alive forevermore."
Yeah.
Well, I mean, when was Jehovah dead?
Yeah.
Obviously, it's Jesus speaking, and yet he's the one who's said to be the first and the last and the Almighty and so forth.
Well, yeah, definitely stumped her, and she said, "Well, I'll have to have somebody else come back and explain that." So I think they're going to send an elder back or something.
Well, that's good. Yeah, that's good. I mean, sometimes Jehovah's Witnesses are seekers after truth. Although the ones who've been Jehovah's Witnesses the longest are not the ones that I have found to be the most open-minded.
Yeah.
It's often the younger ones that are seekers after truth. But on the other hand, if you've been in that organization long enough, you might get disillusioned with it just as people get disillusioned with their churches, you know. And so there's always hope that you might catch somebody who's open. But these people are pretty brainwashed. You know.
Yeah, I got that. Well, when her answers were just, I mean, literally verbatim according to this book I'm reading, I mean, just word for word, it just blew me away how just
right.
Exact it was. Anyway, I have one more real quick question.
Okay.
John 5:20. Something that's not reconciling in my own mind is, Is this actually saying Jesus Christ is the true God?
The true God?
Or is it still referring to the Father?
See, that's a hard thing. I think that he could be saying that Jesus is the true God in eternal life, but the way it's worded, a Jehovah's Witness or somebody who didn't believe that could say, no, he's talking about the Father, because it could go either way in the way it is spoken. It says, "And we know that the Son of God has come."
Yeah.
And has given us an understanding that we may know him that is true, and we are in him who is true. And he means there the Father, because he's even in his Son, Jesus Christ. So the one that he says is him that is true is a reference to the Father and in his Son, Jesus Christ. And then he says, this is the true God and eternal life. This could be a reference to Jesus Christ, whom he last mentioned, or it could be a reference to him that is true, who clearly is a reference to the Father. So while as a person like myself who believes that Jesus is God, can understand this as an affirmation of Jesus, it could not be proven beyond question. It wouldn't be the strongest argument you could use.
Yeah, I made the mistake of quoting that one. I was kind of skeptical. I just asked the person, well, what do you think of this? She goes, well, if you mean it to be Jesus Christ, I think you're just horribly twisting the scriptures. But I could go either way in my mind.
Yeah, it's ambiguous. It's ambiguous. And the trouble is that as a Trinitarian, I could see it either way and it'd be equally good, you know?
Yeah.
But as a Jehovah's Witness, they can only see it one way, and if it goes the other way, it disproves their doctrine. So they have to depend on it being one way. But it's ambiguous. It could go the other way, and it would hurt them. But since you can't prove which one John means, you can't really use it to prove it to them.
Do you have any additional witnessing tips for them? Besides?
Well, you know, it's hard to say. It's hard to say, you know, you've read good books on it. I've talked to Jehovah's Witnesses many times. When I witness to anybody, whether they're Jehovah's Witness or not, I try to be intuitive in what the Spirit would want me to say to them, you know? I do know all the answers for them. I mean, I read the books on witnessing to Jehovah's Witnesses when I was a teenager. I read Walter Martin's Kingdom of the Cults and other books that were written, so I've been witnessing to Jehovah's Witnesses in their homes and in mine since I was about 16 or 17, and I'm 53 now. And I've certainly could never count the number of conversations I've had. I'm aware of everything they say, but I couldn't tell you, well, when they say this, you say that necessarily, because then I'd be doing what they do, giving you pat answers. Yeah. I think that the best thing for you to do is know your own scriptural position, know the best scriptures that support what you have to say and be able to exegete them. That is, show why the Greek and the context and all of that insists that it means what you say. And then just bring up whatever the Spirit leads you to bring up, you know, in a conversation. If the Spirit is leading you, it's far better than even if you have ironclad arguments that you've pre-arranged to say, because this is a spiritual warfare. When people come in the Jehovah's Witness cult, they have the spirit of Antichrist. I mean, I believe that they really are deceived by doctrines of demons. And therefore, it's a spiritual warfare, not just an academic contest that you're in. And that's why I would suggest just be led by the Holy Spirit. Be prepared.
Yeah.
Know what they believe. Know what you believe. Know why they believe what they do, how they're likely to support it, and know why you believe it. And I mean, like on this program, I get asked lots of questions I've been asked before, but I've never wanted to have just pat answers. I just want to talk to the people, you know, and obviously the answers I give are similar to the same questions when they repeat, but I just don't want to memorize answers and just regurgitate them. You know, I want to talk to people and get some kind of a sense of what the Spirit may want to say to them, and that's what I'd recommend that you do with them or anyone else that you witness to.
Yeah, okay. Well, you know, like, there's just so many ways of going about it. It's just what sticks my mind is always to go and show the deity of Jesus Christ, who he really is.
Well, one thing I would say is that from time to time, since they always come in twos, I assume there were two who came to you.
Yeah, a little 10-year-old girl.
Okay, yeah.
They start them off young nowadays.
Right, yeah. They always come in twos, and it's usually a younger one being mentored by an older one. And I would direct my comments toward the younger one in most cases, or I should say, whichever one seems to be open. Because for the most part, you don't find Jehovah's Witnesses to be open. They're just, as I said, programmed. They're programmed to, when they hear this thing, it pushes a button that releases this answer that they've memorized. But from time to time, you find there's a real human being in there. I mean, there's a real person who's, you know, there's somebody like you or me who happened to not know how to refute the Jehovah's Witnesses when they came to their door, and they thought they're right, and so they joined the group.
Yeah.
But they're real lovers of truth, and they could leave the group if they could be shown that something's wrong. So my suggestion would be, don't waste too much time on the person who does not appear to be open. I mean, Jesus said, don't cast your pearls before swine. But there are, you know, on occasion, you will find that the younger one, or at least one of the two in the group, does seem to have a, you know, an interest in the truth. I mean, when they hear your arguments, instead of just snapping back, they might be stunned for a moment and say, wow, I hadn't thought of that, or I need to look that up, or something like that, you know?
Well, I mean, and, the girl was probably 9 or 10 years old. I could see her eyes light up, and she's very attentive as to what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
I felt like I'd be overstepping my boundaries to specifically speak to her rather than her mentor.
Yeah, it is. It is. I always wonder about that too. You know, trying to talk to a child when their parent has entrusted them to somebody. But on the other hand, Jesus said, "Permit the little children to come to me, and don't forbid them." And if the parents are forbidding them, you know, then maybe you can go over their heads. But it is, I'm always I always feel a little awkward trying to communicate to a child anything that I know their parent would not approve of. But on the other hand, we have some obligations to preach to every creature.
Yeah, okay. Well,
hey, Bob.
That was my first experience with them, and I'll keep studying and see what I can do, because I'm sure they'll come back sooner or later.
Yeah, yeah. Well, if you give them answers that are too good, they won't keep coming back.
Yeah. Yeah, they are tough, you know, and when you do read, if anybody's out there that's listening that reads Ron Rose's book, you know, he does state, you know, you will get frustrated because these people are indoctrinated to just come back with specific answers.
Yeah, and they have blacklists. They have a blacklist. When they go to someone's house a couple times and see that they're getting nowhere, and especially if they find that person is articulating good arguments against them, they put them on a blacklist. They skip that house.
Yeah, okay. All right, well, I'm going to let you go, and I'm going to listen to the rest of the program. And I thank you very much for your answers, and I'll just keep studying to show myself approved.
All right, good man. God bless you, Bob.
I'll see you later. God bless you.
Okay,
bye-bye.
You too. Bye-bye. All right, let's look at another question here. Well, here's one that comes from Virginia, who's been waiting since early in the program, from Carmel, California. Virginia, welcome to the Narrow Path.
Hi. I had a question asked me the other day by a new Christian, and I'd never had this question before, and I don't have an answer, so I would like to hear what you have to say. She said that Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and John were all written, you know, by people that need Christ, and yet why do we not have anything written by Jesus? Why did he not write anything? Or to our knowledge, we have nothing that he wrote.
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, I mean, just a minor point there. Not all of those men knew Christ. Luke, in all likelihood, did not know Christ, but his friends did.
Right.
Luke traveled with the apostles, and Mark probably knew Christ, though he was not one of the apostles, and Matthew and John certainly were apostles. But as far as why Jesus didn't write anything, I honestly don't know. I mean, I think what he ended up doing proved to be good enough. I mean, he entrusted his teaching to 12 men, and some of them put it in writing, and all of them, you know, communicated it verbally wherever they went, and Christianity took hold and has become, you know, obviously one of the largest belief systems in the world. Although I would like it if Jesus had written something. It apparently wasn't the will of God. Jesus did whatever his Father told him to do, and I don't know why he didn't write. But as it turns out, his teachings were preserved, and his life story was preserved well enough. So I really can't answer why he didn't do it. We know that Jesus was literate. He could write.
Yeah, yeah. He could. So you would think there would be a letter or there'd be something that he had written.
There is a letter that is alleged to be from Jesus to the king of Edessa. I believe it is. If you read in Eusebius's Ecclesiastical History, which is an ancient book of church history written in 325 A.D. by a bishop of Antioch, Eusebius, he said that there was a time in Jesus' lifetime that there was a king, I'm pretty sure it was the king of Edessa, if I'm not mistaken, but this king had, I forget if he was sick or he had a sick son. It's been a long time since I read the story. It's very probably not true, but it could be. And this man wrote to Jesus asking if Jesus would come and heal either himself or whoever was sick in his family. And Jesus wrote a letter back to him and said, I can't come right now because I've got things to do down here in Judea, but once I've died and risen from the dead, I'll send one of my disciples to you, and he'll pray for you, he'll heal you. And according to Eusebius, that did happen. But, you know, we don't have any manuscripts of that alleged letter, and I think most scholars would doubt that the story was really true. But it has a very ancient, you know, attestation, and, I mean, not quite ancient enough. 325 AD is pretty long after the time of Christ. So anyway, there's that tradition that Jesus wrote a letter, but he didn't write epistles like Paul did, or he didn't write down, you know, a book of sayings like Solomon did, or in Proverbs. But nonetheless, I guess the essential teachings of Jesus did get written down, and maybe he knew, because he, you know, he was a Jew, and he saw what the Jews did with the written scriptures. They worshipped the written scriptures. I mean, Jesus said to the Jewish opponents of his in John chapter 5, he says, "You search the scriptures because in them you think you have eternal life, but they testify of me, and you won't come to me that you might have life." So he may have felt that if he wrote something, then his written documents would become more the focus of people's interest and of their worship and reverence and veneration than himself.
Yeah.
And this has happened in some sectors, even with the writings of his apostles, as far as that goes. I mean, let's face it, there are many in the Christian church, not as many as there once were, but there are many who, you know, have almost idolatrous attitude toward the Bible itself, when indeed it's supposed to be pointing us to Jesus. And people can make the mistake of thinking that because they have the writings and because they've read and understand and believe the writings, that they have found Christ.
Mm-hmm.
And I imagine if we had writings from Jesus, there'd be even a greater temptation to think that way toward his writings. But that,
yeah,
I don't know that to be the reason. I just, yeah, it just crossed my mind.
Yeah, it's a good thought. Yeah, okay, thanks a lot.
All right, God bless you, Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks for calling.
Mm-hmm.
Bye-bye. Okay, we've got a call from our friend in Torrington, Connecticut, Jim, who's been calling me for 9 or 10 years now. Hi, Jim.
Hey, Steve, how are you?
Good.
Where were you last week?
Hawaii.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Did you have a good time?
I always have a good time in Hawaii. I've been there about 45 times, probably.
Oh, goodness. I flew through there once, landed at the airport. That was it.
Yeah, I showed up at church here in Santa Cruz yesterday morning, and the greeter at the door said, "You're the first person I've ever seen who spent a week in Hawaii and didn't get any tan." But I've been in Hawaii, as I said, between 40 and 45 times, and I have been to the beach maybe half a dozen times in Hawaii. I mean, I spend almost the entire time indoors teaching when I'm there. I don't see much sun.
Well,
but it looks nice outside. Looking out the windows, it looks pretty.
Oh, geez, that's kind of a waste. Well, not a waste, but you know what I'm saying.
You think so? Well, don't tell them, because they're paying for me to come over.
Yeah, that's true. You can't go
away.
They
pay my effort.
I have a question about the JWs. I stumbled on this. I don't know if God kind of gave this to me or not. You never know about these things. But, you know, I was asking him one time. I said, when Thomas met the risen Christ, and, you know, and he, you know, touched his wounds and all that, I said, he fell down and said, "My Lord, my God."
They say he was cussing.
Huh?
The Jehovah's Witnesses say he was cussing.
Yeah, well, you know, no, I had hearsay.
That's what they told me.
Yeah, the ones I talked to said yes, because he is a God, you know. So the ones told you he was cussing.
Yeah, several. In fact, that's the answer they usually have given me.
Oh, okay. Well,
maybe the ones you talked to had not been fully trained yet, and they didn't know that's supposed to be their answer. And so they get an answer off the top of their head.
Yeah, because saying Lord, that was, you know, they agree with that's fine, you know.
Yeah.
Oh. So they say he was cussing, huh?
Well, they don't say cussing.
Right.
But they say it was an expletive. They say he was just shocked and used the word "God, my God" as an expletive, which, you know, we'd say swearing.
My Lord was an expletive too?
Well, I guess they would say so. I don't agree with them, of course. I believe that Thomas recognized that Jesus was God and said so, and Jesus didn't rebuke him for saying so.
But didn't say,
"Hey, you're blaspheming."
Right. But they do believe Jesus is a God, right?
Yes, yeah, they believe that there's, you know, anyone could be a God. Not in the sense that the Mormons think that we'll all be gods, but that is
right.
To say anyone who has certain superiority might be called a god. The devil, they say, is called the god of this world.
Right.
Yet he's not God, but he's called the god of this world. And they point out that Moses was referred to as being like a god to Pharaoh.
Right.
And Aaron was his prophet. And so they say, yeah, it's not strange to speak about people as gods. Even in Psalm 82, the judges were referred to as gods.
Right.
And so in other words, the word God is used sometimes of people who are not really God. But the real question is, if Thomas said, my God,
right.
As a Jew, a Jew's God is Yahweh. He's not saying that the devil is his God. I mean, it may be that we call the devil the God of this world,
right.
Because some people in the world worship the devil,
right.
But he's not Thomas's God. And Moses isn't Thomas's God, and, you know, the judges of Israel aren't Thomas's God. When he says, my God, he's obviously speaking of, the object of his worship.
Yeah,
he's
worshiping. I would ask, you know, because like I said, I've dealt with witnesses a number of times over the years, and I've asked them, was he right in calling him my God? And they said, yes, he was, that Jesus was a God. And the Lord, and, you know, and so my comeback to them, which caught them off guard, I said, so he was correct in saying my God? And they said, yes. And I said, so he's your God? And they looked at me, and I would say to them, will you say that Jesus is my God? And they don't.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's a good,
yeah.
That's a good way to turn it on. See, you know as well as I do that in John 1:1 they retranslate it to say that the Word was a God.
Right.
So they don't have any problem saying that Jesus was a God. But that's a good point. I mean, when Thomas says, my God,
right.
He's not saying one of my gods, one of my many gods, or one of my two gods. You know, he said, my God. As if there's only one God that is his God, and that was Jesus. And that's good to ask him, but, well, would you say that?
Right, and they won't, you know. So then you turn around and say, well, then Thomas must have been wrong. But they say, well, no, not the ones I thought would said that. I don't know if it's different on the East Coast here or what, but...
Things are different on the East Coast, but I think Jehovah's Witnesses are pretty standardized.
Yeah, I know, yeah, pretty much. But we're closer to the Watchtower, so maybe we get the better stuff there.
Maybe you get the pure stuff.
Yes, we do. All right, Steve.
Okay, Jim, good talking, man.
Yeah, good to have you back.
All right, thank you.
Okay.
Bye-bye now. Somebody told me that they, when they played recorded programs last week when I was gone, that the same program was played Monday and Thursday. I didn't know that, and that might have been an oversight at the studio. But anyway, we're live again. If you were listening last week and wondered if we're live today, today is Monday. What is the date? It's 15th or something of January, and... My name is Steve Gregg. You're listening to The Narrow Path. You can call me. We have another call we're going to take right away. We have some lines open at 1-800-438-5090. If you want to call and ask a question about the Bible or Christianity or talk about something you disagree with the host about, feel free to call 1-800-438-5090. Bud from Reedville, Oregon. Hello, Bud.
Hi, Steve.
Hi.
Long time no see.
Yeah, I'm going to be coming up there again, you know, in a couple weeks.
Yeah. I'd like to see, I've got this problem, though, right now. I was wondering if you might know somebody that could possibly help. I'm experiencing something that seems like demon possession or oppression. I was wondering if you knew anybody in this area.
There is a guy in the Albany area, he deals with people who have demonic problems. I don't know him well, and therefore I don't know if I can recommend him. You know, some people, I'm not saying this is true of this man, but some people are demon chasers, and they tend to see demons everywhere, even where there aren't demons. Just every abnormality is seen as a demon possession. And frankly, I'm cautious about recommending somebody to you who is, who specializes in demons only because they tend to be, a one-stringed instrument that they play, and they do see everything that way. And I don't know that I'd want to send you something like that unless I personally felt like you had that problem. But you can write to me, and I can try to give you the phone number of that guy, and you can just use your discretion. But could you give me some idea of why you think that problem exists?
I'm a person that has been hearing voices for about 14, 13 years or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But I picked them up mainly when I was doing drugs a lot and some other sins.
Mm-hmm.
And then I quit the drugs and the other sins, which and then the voices tailed off real low, and they weren't that all that much of a problem. They weren't, you know, terrifying anyway. They were
mm-hmm.
a problem.
Do you pray against them specifically?
Yes.
What happens when you do that? Anything?
I can get them to quiet down, and I can get some victory, and then sooner or later they come back, and it comes back real strong.
Yeah.
This started real bad about 13 days ago or so. I've been trying to take care of some past wrongs before, some stuff that I did before I was a Christian.
Mm-hmm.
And I got real scared to do this one thing, and I started feeling like a condemnation feeling.
Yeah.
And I thought it was Jesus, and I didn't know, you know, I always prayed to Jesus, and when I felt that feeling, I told Jesus I couldn't do that thing, and I asked him to do it. I don't know how he would, but I just couldn't do it. I asked him to do it, and then I got real peaceful, and then the next day the condemnation feelings came back. And
well, you know, Bud, the truth of the matter is, man, I'd like to talk to you off the air, because obviously you can't tell a lot of details on the air, and you know, the way that you have to be kind of evasive, you know, in a public airing like this makes it less possible for me to know how to assess the problem, know what to recommend. But I would be certainly willing to talk to you and maybe put you in touch with this guy in Albany. And of course, I'd love to see you when I come up. Now, this is the Bud I know, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
I thought so. So, I mean, I have your address. And why don't we get in contact off the air sometime?
Okay. By mail?
Or you want to call me?
You could call me if you don't want to give out your...
Okay. Why don't I have my call screener put you on hold? I'll put you on hold, and the call screener can take your phone number down.
Okay.
And then I'll try to call you off here.
Thank you, Steve.
Okay. Sorry about your issues you're dealing with there, and we'll see if we can find a biblical solution.
Thank you.
All right. God bless you.
Bye.
Stay on the line. I'll put you on hold. Okay, and production, I think Dwayne's probably there. Can you get his phone number for me? Thank you. Let's talk now. Well, let's see. I don't know if I can talk to somebody else while he's on hold. It might take him, it might cut him off here. I can only have one caller online at the time, so if I take another caller, I don't know if it'll bump him. In any case, I will get in touch with you, Bud. If this happens to bump you and I take this next call, I'll get in touch with you. We have your address. Let's talk to Stoy from Eugene, Oregon. Hi, Stoy. Welcome to the Narrow Path.
Hi, Steve. How are you?
Good.
I have a homestay who's a senior in high school, and she's an international student, so she can't go to public school, so she goes to a Catholic school, and she comes home and tells me what she's learned. But she came home the other day and asked me what theory I believed in. Was it Genesis 1 or Genesis 2? So she's being taught that
there's contradiction between the two.
Yeah, and I tried to explain to her as much as I could, but have you come across that before?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's one of the first things people encounter when they start reading the Bible. They encounter the fact that Genesis chapter 1 gives a chronological sequence of creation acts on the first 6 days of creation, and then Genesis 2 begins by telling about God resting on the seventh day, and then it starts all over again and gives a creation story that looks different. And some people think the second one contradicts the first.
Mm-hmm.
And that's apparently the view that the Catholic school is teaching her. And so she thinks that you have to take your pick. Actually, I've never had any problem seeing both stories as correct. They actually, what we have there is a panorama in chapter one of the whole creation week, whereas chapter two focuses on the activities of a single day. It's true that the chapter two's account, which begins in verse four, it does mention an earlier point than the first day, before God had made man and before it had rained and before there were even plants on the earth. It starts there, but then it jumps to the sixth day. It doesn't say it's the sixth day, but we're already told that in the previous chapter. He jumps to the creation of man, and he tells about the details of how he put man in the garden, and he made a woman for the man after he had the man name the animals and so forth. And so what we have in chapter 2 is a focus on events of the sixth day. Once it says in verse 7 that God made man in his own image, or made man from the dust of the earth, after that, it simply focuses on how the sixth day transpired and what God did with man during that day. Now, this, I think, is comparable, and I usually have pointed this out when people have asked, that it's comparable to the way that some magazine articles are written. For example, in a news magazine, if you're reading about the war in Iraq or some story, there may be a main story, and then there's what they call a sidebar, where there's a boxed, you know, a section that has, you know, some other paragraphs in it that focus on one aspect of the story because it's important, but they didn't want to interrupt the flow of the story in order to give all this information. So they give it as a sidebar, sort of what we might even compare with the function of a footnote. And I think that chapter two is like a sidebar. The creation of man and woman and the naming of the animals and all occurred on the sixth day. But in chapter one, when it's telling the story of the 6 days, it doesn't want to go into all that detail because chapter one is written with a great deal of symmetry. It wants to quickly give you the outline of the whole week. And so the sixth day is treated without much more detail than the other days are. Because actually, I think the first account is mainly there to focus on or to highlight the Sabbath and to give the reason why the Sabbath became part of the Jewish law, because God rested on the seventh day. The second account, I think, is mainly there to highlight the institution of marriage and to show why marriage is, because the chapter ends by saying, therefore a man shall leave his father and mother and cleave unto his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. So in other words, after telling the story of the creation of Adam and Eve and God bringing them together, Moses, the commentator who wrote it, said, now this is why men leave their parents and become married. And so we have, I think, in the two creation accounts, different focuses. One is the focus on the seventh day, which means that the story of the first 6 days is covered over rather rapidly to get to the seventh day and say, this is why God sanctified the seventh day. But then the second account, you know, gives a lot more detail about what happened on the sixth day. It's like a sidebar or like a footnote or an appendix or something where it talks about, you know, the separate creation of man and woman. Creation of man and woman are mentioned as a single event in the first account. At the, you know, Genesis 1:26 or 27, it says that God made man his own image, male and female, he made them. And it doesn't give the kind of detail that chapter 2 gives. But that detail is valuable, especially to explain where marriage, the institution of marriage, came from. And that's why I think that additional detail is given.
Yeah, that's what I tried to explain to her, that it's, you know, now it's going to talk about more detail. And but she was also told that the stories in the Bible are just made up for examples. And,
well,
you know,
she's got liberal teachers, of course. I mean, the Catholic scholarship accepts much of the liberal position on the Pentateuch, on the first five books. If you, like, when I was young, I read through many versions of the Bible. One version I read through was the New Jerusalem Bible, which was a Catholic translation. and it had extensive footnotes. And I remember when I was reading through the Pentateuch, the footnotes all presupposed the liberal view that, you know, the Pentateuch was not written by Moses, that it was the result of four traditions, J, E, P, and D. It's called the documentary hypothesis. It's a liberal position, and it's not true, but the Catholic Bible assumed it to be true. So there's a very common persuasion among liberals that at least the first 11 chapters of Genesis are not historical. They may waffle a little bit on the historicity of Abraham. Some would say, well, you know, when in chapter 12, where Abraham's story begins to be told, maybe we start to have some connections with history there. But they think that the first 11 chapters that have the creation and the fall and Cain killing Abel, and then there's the flood, and then there's the Tower of Babel, they think all of that is non-historical. And they say that, well, the Jews wrote those to be kind of some people use the term pious fiction, you know, stories to make a point, but that aren't really intended to be taken historically. And that's apparently what this school is teaching her.
Yeah.
Now, I would point out a number of things to indicate that the first 11 chapters should be taken as historical. Mm-hmm. One of them is that the writer goes to great pains to connect everything chronologically. For example, after telling the story of Adam and Eve and Cain and Abel, chapter 5 is devoted to giving great detail about 10 generations of people who lived and died and who their children were and how many years they lived before their children were born, how many years they lived afterwards, and so forth. I mean, a lot of detail given about 10 generations from Adam to Noah. Then it stops and tells the story of Noah in great detail. And then the Tower of Babel is given in great detail in chapter 11. Well, not great detail, but plenty. And then in the end of chapter 11, it gives another genealogy, another 10 generations from Noah to Abraham. And it doesn't give quite as much detail, but it gives plenty of detail about their age and everything, how long they lived. And most of the characters in these genealogies in chapter 5 and in chapter 11, most of these guys are not important enough to be mentioned if you're just writing fiction. If you're just writing fables or something, you just tell the stories and you wouldn't connect them with this kind of chronological data. And so at least the author seems to be giving the impression that the first 11 chapters are intended to be taken as historical, that he's not writing them as pious fiction. Now, if he's lying, that's one thing, but Jesus believed that those stories were true. Jesus quoted from Genesis 2:24, when in Matthew 19 he was asked about divorce. And he said, well, haven't you read what it says that, you know, God made man and woman in his own image, and then he declared, for this cause shall a man leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife, and the two shall be one flesh. And what God has joined together, let not man put asunder. Now, Jesus is assuming that story in Genesis about Adam and Eve and that statement is true. And it's not only true, but it's true enough to govern our behavior and to set moral standards for marriage and divorce. If it was a fable, then it wouldn't really provide a precedent for anything. It's just a made-up story. Likewise, Jesus talked about the days of Noah in Matthew 24, and that's in Genesis 6 through 9. So Jesus said, as it was in the days of Noah, you know, they ate and they drank and they married and were given in marriage until the flood came and took them all away. He seemed to indicate that that was reality, that that really happened. And so, Jesus and others in the scripture, Jesus believed in Cain and Abel also in Genesis 4, because he said in Luke 11, I think it is, around verse 49 or 50, Jesus said that all the blood of all the prophets who was shed from Abel to Zechariah will come upon this generation. Now, he said that the Jews of his generation were going to be punished for the righteous blood that was shed by their ancestors from the time of Abel, which is Genesis 4, till the time of Zechariah, who is in 2 Chronicles. And, you know, you don't punish people for the death of someone who never really lived at all. You know, it's one thing to say, all the real people who died, God's going to lay that to your door. It's another thing to say, God's going to blame you for the death of real people who died and even fictional people who died. Well, how can anyone be responsible for the death of someone who died in fiction?
Yeah.
Anyone other than the author, that is.
Yeah. Oh, good. Well, thank you so much.
All right. So Jesus believed they were literal. Yeah, Jesus believed the chapters were historical.
Oh, good. Well, thank you so much, Steve. I appreciate it.
All right. Thanks for your call, brother.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye now. All right, let's talk to another Bob today. We've had one Bob. Here's another Bob. This one's Bob from Portland. Hi, Bob. Welcome to the Narrow Path.
Yes. I've contributed to your radio station, by the way.
Oh, great.
And I just wanted to let you know. But anyway, I just wanted to say that Jesus said, my words are not my own, but his that sent me. And Jesus is called the Word of God. He is God's Word. In fact, he's the author of the Bible. He inspired Moses in the writing of the first five books. He is also called Jehovah of Hosts. In Isaiah 44:6, it says, thus saith Jehovah, the King of Israel, and his Redeemer.
I know, and I think you've quoted that verse every time you've called, Bob, and I agree with you. I agree with you. Appreciate you calling about that. We're going to talk next to Levi, who's calling from Spartanburg, South Carolina, next. And let's see, I'd like to tell you we have a line or two open, but I guess we're running a little late. But you can try to get in at 1-800-438-5090. You're listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and our next caller is Levi. Hello, Levi from South Carolina.
Hello, Steve. How you doing?
Fine, thanks.
Good. Hey, I have a gentleman on my job who's a Jehovah's Witness. And me and him was talking, and he, I had told him that Jesus had made claims that he was God. And he right away responded and said, no, Jesus never made the claim that he was God. So my question is, isn't that the reason why he was crucified? Because he made claims that he was God in the flesh.
Well, Jesus was crucified because the Jews were jealous of him, and they did accuse him of blasphemy. Although he was crucified by the Romans for a different reason, because the Romans didn't care about blasphemy. The Sanhedrin was the ruling, court of the Jews, and they accused Jesus of blasphemy because he said he was the Messiah, the Son of the Blessed, which they considered to be a blasphemous claim. But they couldn't crucify him because only the Romans could do that legally. So they took him to the Roman authorities, and they charged him with a different crime, which was sedition. But as far as whether Jesus claimed to be God, I would say you will not find a verse in the Gospels where Jesus said these exact words, I am God. But you will find, by the way, there's a lot of noise on your line. I think I'm going to go ahead and drop you if that's okay. Can you listen? Are you listening on the Internet?
Yes.
Okay, do you mind if I drop the call because there's some line noise?
Okay, and one other question with that. Is the Messiah,
okay,
does that actually mean the incarnation of God? We go ahead and drop the line and I'll listen to you.
Okay, I appreciate your call, brother.
Okay, thanks.
Bye. Actually, the word Messiah does not in itself mean the incarnation of God. The Jews did not necessarily all understand the word Messiah to refer to the incarnation of God, but if you take all the Old Testament scriptures about the Messiah, then one would have to conclude something like he is God, because Isaiah 9:6 is talking about the Messiah, and it says his name should be called Wonderful Counselor, the Mighty God, the Everlasting Father, the Prince of Peace. And the Messiah is called the Mighty God and the Everlasting Father, so it's difficult not, at least for us in hindsight, to not recognize that the Messiah idea included the idea of him being God. But the Jews, the rabbis, had a lot of different ideas about the Messiah. Some thought he'd be kind of a divine being. Some thought he'd be just another guy like David, another hero who would come along and just be a military hero who would rule the nation after he drove out the enemies. And there were a lot of confusion. The rabbis definitely did not all have the same opinion. A Jewish friend of mine said that whenever you get three Jews in a room, you'll have four opinions. And that was kind of that way about the Jewish opinions about the Messiah. Lots of different opinions. Some thought there were going to be two Messiahs. One Messiah ben Joseph, who would suffer, and one Messiah ben David, who would rule. So, I mean, there are just a lot of different ideas out there. The way the Old Testament informs us, and if the Jews had seen it clearly enough, they should have understood, the Messiah, yes, is supposed to be God. Now, as far as Jesus saying, I am God, no, he didn't use those words. But he said many things which were intended to make them know that he's claimed to be God. Even when he said, I am the good shepherd of the sheep in John 10, he was using an expression that comes from the Old Testament, where in Psalm 23, David said, Yahweh, or Jehovah, is my shepherd. And in Ezekiel 34, Yahweh, or Jehovah, said that he would come and be a shepherd to his people because the earthly shepherds were bad shepherds. And Jesus came along and said, I'm the good shepherd, meaning I'm Yahweh. I'm the fulfillment of Ezekiel 34. I'm the shepherd of Israel. And so, I mean, there's lots of titles Jesus used for himself. Even the I am expression he used in John 8:58 was a divine title. So in a sense, he did say he was God, but he just didn't use the exact words saying, I am God. By the way, the Jews understood that Jesus was claiming to be God, even when he didn't use those words, as we can see in John chapter 5 and verse 17, or 18. John 5:18 says, therefore the Jews sought all the more to kill him, because he not only broke the Sabbath, but he also said that God was his Father, making himself equal with God. And so they thought he, by calling God his Father, that he was claiming to be God. And they understood him that way. And actually, John seems to be saying that too. John doesn't say they thought he was making himself equal. He says that he said God was his Father, making himself equal with God. That's John's comment. And that's why they wanted to kill him. So I'd say the Jehovah's Witnesses are mistaken in their theology, but they're not wrong if they say Jesus never said these words, I am God. True, he didn't say those words, but he claimed to be God in many ways in his ministry. Not much time left. I'm afraid we've got three calls waiting, and I don't have even so much as 3 minutes left. Let's see if we can give Rusty a few minutes here. Rusty, welcome to The Narrow Path.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for taking my call. Real quick. In Genesis, when Moses was told to leave the ark, he was told in a specific order. He was told to leave him, his wife, his sons, and his sons' wives. And then later on, he left, but when he left the ark, he left him, his sons, his wives, and his sons' wives. And I have a dear brother of mine who says that because he did not leave in a specific order that God told him to, that he brought disunity between man and his wife.
I think that's nonsense. First of all, we're talking about Noah, not Moses. But the thing is...
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. But the thing is, I mean, that's just a manner of God being explicit about who's supposed to go in and who's supposed to go out. God is not telling him what order they have to walk up the gate. And I think that expression, that conclusion is not well-founded.
Okay, because I was wondering if maybe there was scriptural evidence for him to have that, and I've never even heard it before, and I was kind of caught off guard by it. So I think
your friend was just trying to get some insights from the passage and read too much into it.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Steve.
All right, Rusty, good talking, man.
You too.
Bye bye now. My apologies to Cedric in Seaside, California, and Benjamin in Gonzales, California, who wanted to get on, and we just the music's playing, we're out of time. Please call tomorrow. I'd love to talk to both of you and anyone else who wants to be on the program with us in the future. You've been listening to The Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg. We do this Monday through Friday from 2 to 3 in the afternoon, Pacific Standard Time. And I should make, real quickly, a couple of announcements. One is that this Friday night we have our monthly Salinas meeting. Now, if you went to the last one, you might think it doesn't seem like it's been a month. It's true. That's only three weeks this time. Because I'm going to Oregon the following week, which is when we normally would be in Salinas. So this Friday night will be our next Salinas meeting. Then the following Friday, the 26th of January, and the 27th, Saturday, I will be in Oregon speaking in McMinnville and the Portland area and Albany. And you can find information about those things at our website. And I want you to know about that. So our website is www.thenarrowpath.com. If you're interested in coming to those meetings, you can go to the announcements link. The announcements link will always tell where I'm going to be. The Narrow Path is a listener-supported ministry. If you'd like to help pay the bills, as Bob said he did when he called, and I appreciate that, Bob. Thank you so much. You can help us by sending a contribution. None of it goes to me. It all goes to the radio stations. The address is The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 3633, Santa Cruz, California, 95063. If you need to find that address,